Hello, mamas, and welcome back to the Pregnancy with Physio Laura podcast. Today, I'm talking to the incredible Sophie Walker, who runs the Australian Birth Stories podcast, and we are chatting about all of the amazing themes and things that she has learned from interviewing hundreds of women over the years. So enjoy.
Hey, mama, I'm sending you wonderful pregnancy vibes. It's time for take some time for you. It's Pregnancy with Physio Laura.
Hello, mamas, and welcome back to the Pregnancy with Physio Laura podcast. Oh my gosh, it has been a long time between drinks. As you would probably know from the last podcast episode, I have taken a break from the podcast. I'm currently traveling in a caravan around Australia with my young family. I am also growing a fourth baby, and it has been the most incredible experience so far. I'm currently sitting in just the local library for where we're traveling right now, and this is the first time I've really jumped back into any work. I truly have craved and needed a break. I've needed some time to just switch off and focus on my family. And it's been amazing. And maybe it's a podcast for another day, but the growth, the lessons, the journey I've been on just in the past few months has been profound. And I know that I'll look back and say that this trip that we decided to take has been so transformative to the direction of my life and to where I'm headed next. And yes, all of those things. But apologies for anyone who has missed the podcast. I received a number of messages and I'm so grateful for all of your support. So thank you so much for being here and waiting and wanting to see more of the podcast. I was fortunate enough to bulk record a whole ton of interviews before I left, knowing that I would want some time out on this trip. So I have some amazing interviews lined up and I want to get them into your ears. I really do. So these interviews were recorded before we left on our journey. And the first one today that I want to get into your ears is with the amazing Sophie Walker from Australian Birth Stories podcast. Now, if you haven't already heard of this, which I'm sure you have, it is an amazing podcast which shares Australian women's experiences and journeys of their pregnancy and their births. And I wanted to get Sophie on the podcast. I've known her for many years. She's interviewed me. I've got my birth stories. I've contributed to some of her online products. But she has a really unique perspective on birth, I think, because she is not a professional. She is not an obstetrician. She is not a doula. She is a regular mum who wanted to share stories, who wanted to tap into regular everyday women experiencing a variety of pregnancy and birth journeys to share these stories on the podcast to make women feel less alone. And I think she has a really unique perspective to be able to pull out different themes that she sees on women birthing in Australia, what makes a positive experience, a negative experience, what changes need to be made to the maternity system. And I really wanted to get her insight on all of this. She's written a book and another one coming on the way, and I think she has a really unique perspective to be able to talk to this. So again, she's not a professional, but she has interviewed hundreds of women, and I think that's going to share really different insight to what we usually hear on here from the professionals. So I can't wait for you to listen to this episode. I'm so happy to be back in your ears. We will be releasing an episode every week for the next 7 or 8 weeks, and they are going to be the full interview. Usually I break them up into episodes, but they will be the full interview. So you have to listen a little bit longer than you usually do for the Pregnancy with Physio Laura podcast, but I don't want to chew your ear off anymore. Whilst I am excited to be back, I want you to listen to this interview with Sophie. And as always, if you love this interview, or if you want to share some love to the podcast, just jump on over to @PhysioLaura and let me know what you loved about this podcast. And make sure you subscribe because they will be dropping every week for the next little bit. So I love you all. Thank you for being here and enjoy this episode with Australian Birth Stories podcast host, Sophie Walker. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Sophie. Truthfully, before I jumped on, I was actually telling my husband I was a little nervous to interview you because you're the powerhouse podcaster in the room. You have got arguably the biggest pregnancy podcast in Australia. And whilst you've interviewed me a number of times, I've never turned around and been the interviewer to you. So a little bit nervous, but very grateful to have you here. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's funny. I feel like we know each other very well and we have run into each other a couple of times getting coffee. But yeah, totally. Old friends chatting.
It feels that way. I feel like we've been doing this for years now. You and I remember when we did first meet, it was out the front of the op shop. You were getting a coffee. We had a big cuddle and I was like, oh, this is finally happening. So it was so nice.
I told someone the other day, you give the best hugs.
She, I feel really honored.
A nice firm physio hug.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm all in. Yeah. 100%. Oh, that's so funny. So yeah, I'm super grateful to have you. I've actually been wanting to get you on the podcast for a while because I feel you have this very unique perspective of birth and pregnancy in Australia because you've interviewed hundreds of women. And I feel like you've interviewed them coming from this sort of neutral, unbiased place because you are Sophie Walker, mum of three kids. You don't have that like biased professional viewpoint that a lot of people might walk into it. If you're an OB, you come looking at it from your OB point of view. And if you're a physio, you look at it from your physio point of view. Whereas you get to kind of sit back and listen to women's stories and hold the space for women to share. And I think that gives you a really unique perspective on women and pregnancy and birth and how it's all going in Australia. And I just felt like we needed to get you on the podcast to share all of these nuggets of wisdom that you will be carrying from years and years of doing this podcast now. So to start with, obviously acknowledging, again, Australian birth stories, if you haven't heard of it, I'd highly doubt that anyway. Anyone listening right now has definitely heard of it, but go and check it out. Biggest pregnancy podcast in Australia. But what do you think about the way your podcast has taken off, Sophie? There's obviously a power there in women sharing their stories, in wanting to be heard. I remember you saying this, like thousands of women on the wait list for wanting to share their stories. What do you think women are like loving and seeking from this storytelling?
Yeah, I think there's a few different factors why it's so resonated so strongly and then why so many people want to contribute to that kind of library of stories as well. But I think it comes back to, it's funny, I was talking to Jodie, who you've had on recently. I was like, oh, we keep talking about the village and the village, but I feel like it really just comes back to that. And because we've lost that, and that is the easiest and most informative way to learn from one another is to share stories. And I think podcasting has really helped in this day and age bring that back. And I guess that's what the podcast has done. But when I started it, I didn't think, oh, I'm going to make this really successful podcast and it'll turn into a business and then we'll do this and that. I just thought I'll share my story because I enjoyed listening to kind of other stories that I'd heard online. And it was in the very infancy of podcasting. But I think over the years, as people have loved listening to it and felt like they've gained from it, then they've wanted to contribute and give back. And everybody's story is unique and different. And I feel like in every application to come on, they're like, yeah, but you haven't done this or you haven't done this. And it's true. I don't think I'll ever exhaust all the different births and all the different things that can unfold and the choices that people make. And I'll endeavor to do it. I really try hard. But I think there's, yeah, a real sense of wanting to give back if they have taken something away from the podcast. And so that's why over the years that list of people wanting to come on has just grown. And it goes into a spreadsheet that I open a few times a year. And yeah, I'm not even sure how many's in there. But last time I checked, there was 5,000. So the show will go on.
Yeah. And you're so right, I guess, in that we're a little bit more removed from that sit around the campfire and share these stories. So whilst, I guess, in my world, I talk about these birth stories with women face to face, but maybe some people still feel unsure about sharing intimate details of their birth or unsure about how it will be received. Is that weird? Is that too much information? So maybe the podcast is like a way for women to really just feel comfortable in sharing such a rite of passage and make women feel it's okay to share if something didn't go well or if it did go well and just open that dialogue that little bit more.
Yeah. And I think you touched on that I'm not coming in it with a midwife's experience or a physio or an OB. And I've deliberately really tried to be impartial. I've obviously shared my three births so people know the choices that I made and how my births unfolded. But it really doesn't feel like my place to pass judgment. I just let somebody almost in a kind of diary format just retell their story and people can take what they want from it. And there are occasions where I feel like, oh, I can't believe that happened or whatever. And I try not to impart that unless we both do it together. But yeah, that doesn't feel like my role in this. It really is a platform of sharing in a non-judgmental format so people can pick the stories that are interesting to them and take on what they want and leave what they don't.
And do you feel like the women sharing, like that it's a very cathartic experience? Do you feel like that you get a lot of healing and satisfaction from being able to speak the words out loud?
Yeah, and I think there's often a chat before the show and after the show, and often people cry and they go back in and they think, I haven't even thought about that until now. So they've really gone into the details. And so I often tell people to really tread gently for the rest of the day, because we've gone right back into all the emotions of what unfolded, whether it was good or bad or somewhere in between. But yeah, I think there's a cathartic nature, and there's also, it's a beautiful keepsake for them as well. Yeah, I'm just lucky to work in an area where people are so grateful that I've made it and that they have the opportunity to listen. And then the people that come on are grateful for the opportunity to share. Yeah, I feel very fortunate, as I'm sure you do, in the similar space. There's an outpouring of love all the time, which is, yeah, really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, I agree with you in that there's something beautiful from a keepsake point of view. I say to people, like, not everyone gets the opportunity to be interviewed on a podcast to share their birth story, but I encourage people to just make an audio message to themselves recounting what happened, because I recently shared all three of my birth stories on someone's podcast, and I noticed that my summary of it 5 years down the track from my first birth was so different to, say, when I shared my two births on your podcast when I was 6 weeks postnatal. It was so fresh to me. And yeah, I think there's something about recording that moment in time and how you felt about your birth fairly new after it, versus once you're 5-10 years down the track, you skip over those minor details. And there's something about being able to remember all the intricacies and, oh yeah, that happened. And yeah, I encourage people to do an audio message, because I do think there's something beautiful about being able to say to your children one day, hey, this is your birth story, like, you listen to me talk about that. I think that's really beautiful. And what you said about, like, people cry and it brings up all sorts of things, I also had the same experience when I was sharing my third birth story. I was like so good with it. I felt really, there was nothing left over. I just felt really like I'd worked through everything I need to work through. And I got to like the bit where I was talking about Luca coming out. I started crying and I was like, well, obviously there's still stuff in there for me to release. So I feel like podcasting your birth story is a form of therapy. And I think it can be so powerful for women to be able to do that. So yeah, I love what you do. I love how many different things that you've covered. And I know you're always trying to work on covering all bases so women don't feel alone. I just think that's really awesome, because it can be very isolating, particularly if you're having a very unique sort of pregnancy or birth experience. It can be really isolating to find other women going through the same thing. Now, you've interviewed, do you know how many people you've interviewed now, Sophie?
Yeah, there's 383 episodes available at the moment, and I've got a bit of a bang. So yeah, probably nearly 400 episodes.
Okay. So you've interviewed 400 women, and I'm sure you've had countless other conversations about birth. Let's talk about positive birth experiences. Now, we all know that how you give birth doesn't necessarily mean it equals a positive or negative birth experience, but zooming out from that, what's themes that you see around these women that you're interviewing who have had positive birth experiences? What are the themes coming out of those stories that you see that seem to be leading women towards these positive experiences?
I think it's clear as day for me. It's going in feeling informed and understanding, feeling heard in the birth space, and understanding all the things that unfolded. So I've had beautiful feedback from people who perhaps wanted to have an intervention-free home birth, ended up with an emergency cesarean, and said, I loved my birth, because even though it wasn't my first preference, it was maybe option C or D, they felt like when they consented to each procedure, they felt like they were making a confident decision that entertained the idea of maybe this would happen, and said, for example, if I do have to have an emergency cesarean, please have my own music on, let's keep talking to a minimum, or they had preferences. And they weren't blindsided and felt like they were just, a passenger on their own birth. They really felt like they had a say and they were in control. And I think the only way you can do that is by doing all of your homework and educating yourself prior to. I feel like when I started the podcast, a lot of people were coming to it as second and third time mums, and they had a birth experience and had found that I needed to upskill, I needed to know more, I needed to, for whatever reason. For example, with mine, I felt like I didn't really prepare myself for that transition stage. So I really wanted to upskill then. And I feel like initially people were coming in with that experience. I've had a birth experience and this is how I want it to be different. Whereas now I think as the word's gotten out, I've got a lot more people listening for the first time, which is so exciting because then I feel like that they can do all this work and go in and hopefully they don't fall into that category of having a traumatic experience and then have to come back and educate themselves. If we can prevent that as best as possible, then obviously that's the ideal. But I think people who report having a positive birth experience just, in my experience, report just feeling really supported and cared for and having their decisions really respected. And then whether it was what they had initially planned for or not, they still felt empowered in that situation.
Yeah, that's so beautiful to hear, Sophie, because I know that to be true, but I think many women still think that on paper, if you have a physiological vaginal birth, that equals a good, happy experience, and vice versa. If you have an emergency C-section, then that equals a negative or traumatic experience. And it's so much more than that. And it's so beyond that. And I actually interviewed a psychologist and counselor on the podcast, and she said exactly what you said, in that trauma is when you don't feel safe, seen, or soothed. And that's exactly what you're feeding back right now about what women are saying. So regardless of whether they gave birth at home or in the hospital, whether it was with interventions or without interventions, what it's coming back to is, did they feel safe where they were? So that's safe in their environment, safe with their birthing team. Did they feel seen and soothed? So that's about the support and the empowerment and being listened to, like what you're saying. It's about women knowing that their voice is heard and that their preferences are being honored. And I think that's the key message, isn't it? Because I don't know about you, but I still do feel like there's a lot of focus on how you give birth, as in literally, where does the baby come out of? But the more and more I've delved into birth work, the less and less I think that part is important. And the more it's about the emotional and psychological safety surrounding your birth. And I just think that's really powerful for women to understand. And again, that's what you're seeing in these hundreds of women you've interviewed. I'm sure if you went and put in a spreadsheet, because you love spreadsheets, all of the women having positive birth experiences, I doubt there'd be anything on paper that matches up to be like the majority of them had X birth. I'm sure there's a whole variety of different births. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And I know you've had a VBAC with your third, and I feel like a lot of people aspire to go on and have a VBAC. That's like a big portion of my listenership. But I also know someone who had an emergency cesarean, then had a VBAC and wishes she'd had an elective cesarean because she felt out of control in her VBAC. So it's certainly not what's written down on paper, like a gold star for intervention-free or VBAC or what have you. It's really how you felt. And she didn't feel in control in her VBAC. So she reported feeling traumatized. So it all just comes back to feeling in control. And I think we know that having a known care provider throughout your pregnancy and postpartum really supports that sense of control and understanding. And you've discussed your kind of wants and wishes prior to the actual birth, when you perhaps can't articulate what you want in that moment, but they know what you've said over the 8 months or so beforehand. So that all of that goes to supporting feeling cared for and understood.
100%, because I can't imagine what it feels like to have to tell someone from scratch who I am, what my history is, what I like, what I don't like, how I want to be looked after when you're in the throes of labor and you don't know someone. And then we're going to talk a little bit later about the systemic changes that we see needing to be made. And I know that a known care provider is definitely a big one that we're recognizing is important when it comes to this, but we will get to that a little bit later. But it's definitely important. I imagine that's probably another big theme that's coming out of women reporting these positive birth experiences, is probably having that continuity of care and feeling really heard and seen. So on the flip side, women sharing their stories with you who have had negative or traumatic even birth experiences, what do you see being the commonality, and what factors are being shared amongst these women, do you think, that are leading to those less than ideal experiences?
I think a lot of them, and I feel like my first birth was traumatic, and I feel like where I fell down was not entertaining all the possibilities and feeling like, oh, I've exhausted all my options and I'm still at 5 centimeters, so bugger this, give me the epidural and I'll just have the works. Now I don't care, just get the baby out. I feel like there's a certain group of people that have had similar experience like that. I think there's also a big portion of people who, and I often get messages from people, my friend just says she doesn't want to know anything. She's just going to see what happens on the day. And she's, and I know that's not a good option. And it's not a good option because statistically, if you go with the flow, in inverted commas, you're much more likely to have an instrumental birth. And of course, care providers, midwives, obstetricians are very skilled at what they do, but they may not be in line with the choices that you'd like to make. And if, for example, you don't know what an episiotomy is, or you don't know the repercussions of perhaps if you have an epidural, what might unfold after that, if you go in not knowing that, then you're not making informed choices and you're handing over your power. And I think there comes in an element in that kind of school of thought of doctors know best. And of course, they've done training and they've performed many births, and I'm not disrespecting their credentials, but they would also have a certain experience and a viewpoint of how things should unfold, which may not meet or suit your family's needs. I feel like you're setting yourself up for failure, really, by burying your head in the sand or going with the flow. We like to say going with the flow is not a birth plan. And you wouldn't do it with other things in your life. There's that classic thing of if you're buying a fridge or something like that, you do all your research, you ask everyone, you look at all the reviews and stuff, and you're putting your body and your baby in someone else's hands. So you really need to not just screen your doctor, but educate yourself, because you're not the sick person you're birthing. You're part of that team. It's not a transactional kind of medical appointment. So I think those two kind of scenarios, going in without enough strategies and tools, and or doing no research, is really not going to serve you on the day and will, yeah, inevitably lead to trauma. I think other things can unfold. You can go in, you can do all of the research, and you can go in really prepared, and things can just go pear-shaped in birth. And it's, I just interviewed a midwife who's very experienced, who had a really traumatic birth, and it was her grief and trauma was compounded by the fact that she knew all the drugs and the names and the amounts of blood, and she could understand all that with her midwife hat on. And she knew all the risks and she knew all the things, and still her birth just didn't go as planned. So there's an element of unknown in birth, which we all have to accept, and you can prepare as much as you want. And then perhaps I've had a postpartum hemorrhage. You can't predict that. And there's not the preparation or an exercise or something you could have done. So you have to surrender part of the process, but there's a lot you can do to prevent, I think, a lot of the trauma, and also a lot of things you can put in place to support yourself if you do perhaps have a traumatic birth. I feel like there's a real shift in people really preparing for their postpartum to really nurture and support themselves. So if, for example, they do have a really difficult birth and it perhaps doesn't go to plan, they've got a really nurturing team of family and friends or a doula or somebody to help them through.
I think that's such a good point. And I definitely see that big shift into postpartum healing from birth, having birth debriefs, these sorts of things are becoming much more important. I love what you said about go with the flow, because I actually think in like general day-to-day life, that's really praise. Like, you're a chilled, easygoing person. You don't rock the boat. You're just like happy-go-lucky. I think that's got a really positive connotation. But I hear what you're saying. I think unless you fully understand how a hospital system runs and how the maternity system runs and what going with the flow truly looks like through that system, because at the end of the day, they only have a certain amount of beds. They need to get women in and out of the hospital. There's a lot of restrictions on a hospital system. That means that if you're not standing there saying, no, sorry, I actually don't want this, or I do want that, if you're not speaking up, then going with the flow does look like intervention. Because that's just how the system works. Unless you have a really good understanding of that, going with the flow is a little bit scary for a lot of women. And that's obviously the themes you're hearing from women walking into it a little bit naive and fully handing over that trust and control and power to somebody else that's not themselves. So I think that's a really good point to make, that preparation is key. And I assume that's why you wrote a book on how to prepare, because that's what you're seeing. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later on as well, but that's what you're seeing is the deficit. And that's like potentially the key factor that could take someone from just standing back and being a passive player in their own birth to actually fully owning that experience and being able to guide that ship. And like you said, we have to surrender, because we can't control birth, but we can prepare and we can be aware of the things that are in our control and the things that could make it a positive experience. So I think that's really interesting feedback, and I love hearing that from you, and also hearing that iteration that if you do have a traumatic birth, it's not like a set and forget, there's nothing you can do about it. There's so much help that you can get to work through that. Doesn't mean that's the only story you have. You can go on to then have a more beautiful experience, which brings me to you, Sophie. You describe your first birth as traumatic. So could you maybe go into what you think made that birth what you would call a traumatic experience, and then What changed between that first birth to your last birth, your third birth, and how you would have described your third birth, whether that was a positive or a negative experience?
Yeah, with my first, I think, as I touched on, but I labored for about, I had no pain or any kind of signs of real contractions, and I was 4 centimeters. I went in, I was post-date, so I went in and they said, oh, I had a stretch and sweep. She said, you're 4 centimeters. You're going to have a baby this afternoon. And it was like 10 in the morning. And 36 hours later, Nico came out. But I did all the things. I'd listened. I've really felt like I had birth in the bag. I thought, I'm not scared of the challenge or the pain. I'm going to work with it. I did all of Juju Sundin's birth skills, active birthing. Yeah, but I think I gave up when I didn't progress past 5 centimeters. And I think I was stuck at 5 centimeters for about 10 hours. And really, I was in a lot of pain and I just was exhausted. I think at that point I gave up. I often reflect on it and think, oh, maybe if I just had gas and air then, or. But once I agreed to have an epidural and they decided to progress my labor with Syntocin, and I was just on my back. He wasn't in a good position and I lay on my back and had a really heavy epidural. I couldn't wiggle at all on the bed. So then I labored for a long time and he was 4.4 kilos. So I just think maybe he would have got stuck anyway, but I just think being upright and being active would have really helped him perhaps rotate. But I think the real trauma came from his birth when his heart rate dropped when I'd push for 2 hours, and then they were more or less like, his heart rate's really dropping. We need to get him out. And I feel like they ripped him out with forceps. He was all bruised and not breathing. And then I lost 800 mils, which, I mean, now that I'm, that felt like a lot, and it felt like a lot at the time, but now I realize it's not a huge loss, but I could feel it draining from me. So I just thought we were both going to die, to be honest. And I put my head under the sheets and I was just like, I said, Jono, just go and be with the baby. I was like, I don't know what's happening with me. And they managed to get my uterus to clamp down quite quickly. And he actually, I think it really, time stands still at that time, but I think he was only not breathing for a minute. They got him around quite quickly. But I just felt so blindsided by the whole thing. I just went in with such confidence and that I'd have this drug-free, perfect birth. And it just was nothing like I expected. And my mum and my sister and my husband were all really traumatized by it all as well. I think the trauma was the end stage of that, but I did surrender everything and give up midway through. I think what I did differently in between those two births is I thought, okay, I wasn't prepared. I had one plan. So I'm going into birth number two with all the plans. I read up on hypnobirthing techniques. I just really prepared the house for I'm going to stay home longer this time. I think I went in way too early. And I don't know, perhaps if that midwife hadn't have given me a bit of a time frame, maybe I would have been different. But I love the TENS. I thought I'm going to use the TENS again. And this time I'm really going to have some mental strategies to get through that really challenging transition time. And then everything was completely different with this birth. I felt so in control, but I think my app said, call the hospital. And I hadn't even woken up my husband at that stage and I'd only been laboring for an hour or so. And the midwife said, you've had 3 contractions over the phone where you haven't been able to talk to me. So I think it's time to come in. And I more or less checked into the birth center and squatted down on a yoga mat and out Louis came. He was a kilo smaller, so he was easier to push out. But I didn't have any checks, and my midwife was incredible. She just said, if you feel like pushing, you should push. And that felt completely different as well. So he was definitely the easiest birth. And then I went into the third birth thinking, oh, I hear everyone says third births are tricky. And I went in with so much experience and having heard so many stories, but I feel like I did that birth wrong. I think I went in too early again with him, and then he wasn't in a good position, and it went on and on. But I basically had my waters. I went home and then I went back and had my waters broken, and then Otty just rotated and came out in 45 minutes. So even though that was quite quick, it felt a little bit stop-start and I felt a bit disappointed with myself in that birth. So not what I'd expected with my third. And all along I'd wanted a water birth and I never had one in the end. And I think just when the time came, I just didn't feel like it, which is another good learning. You just never know what you're going to want. But yeah, so I notoriously say that Louis's birth was the easiest and he's my hardest child. You never know what you're going to get.
I feel like you can't have it all too good, can you? No. Oh, that's really interesting to hear. So do you feel like the key between, I thought it was your third birth. I got it confused. Sorry. But the key between your first and your second, that sounds like where the biggest change happened. Was that the education piece and the expectation piece and like reading up a little bit more about it and preparing yourself for, say, the transition phase. So was it all that pre-labor work that you'd done to inform yourself and educate yourself that you feel like made the biggest difference? You didn't change your care team or any of those other factors?
No, same midwife, same hospital. Everything was the same in that sense. But I think that one of the biggest things that made the biggest difference for me between first and second was understanding the physiology. I didn't feel scared of birth, but I didn't really understand what was happening. I've got a health degree, but I just didn't really think about contractions in the way that they operated and their purpose. And I really understood that a lot more. So rather than tense up against contractions the second time around, I really felt myself leaning in, and like I can feel it now. I feel like I'm releasing my pelvic floor. And I'm just like really just opening and expanding and letting the body do its thing and working with it rather than tensing against it. I think that's probably one of the biggest. And we all talk about different techniques of having loose lips and stuff, but I really feel like I visualized him moving and felt him rotate in that birth. And I think that made all of the difference.
That's really beautiful. That's really important to hear. And I also did just let go of my pelvic floor too. You don't realize how often you're holding on, do you?
Yeah.
It's a really bad habit of mine. When on this timeline of first baby to third baby, did you start the podcast?
After my second. So
after your second. Okay. I was wondering if listening to women's stories and like being able to hold space for lots of different scenarios, and did that influence at all your third pregnancy and birth journey then? Did that help you heal any parts of it that maybe you hadn't thought to look into? Or was there anything you got out of the podcast and the story specifically that helped you?
I think it's funny because I thought that it really would, but I think in the same way that you hear midwives say they just went into mum mode, I think I just went into birthing woman, and I didn't. I feel like I get so many messages of I drew on this story and I thought of this woman and I thought I would do that and I didn't. I was just a bit of an erratic birthing person, just like I'm over it now, get the baby out. So maybe all that went out the window a bit. I mean, I didn't do anything too crazy in that birth, but I just think I perhaps called my poor midwife who was also pregnant in too early. She's like, are you sure? And that was funny because she said, you can stay in here for a little bit and we'll just see what happens. And she fell asleep because she was like second trimester and exhausted. And then she's, oh, you're still here and you're not even really contracting. So I felt a bit like rejected when she was like, you should probably go home. I was like, oh man, I should know when to come to hospital. But I didn't really. So I think that's interesting as well because you can do all of the learning and things, but you don't know how you'll feel on the day. So It was all probably in there, but I didn't draw on it the way that I perhaps could have.
It's that combo, isn't it, of education and surrender, like what we were speaking about before. You can't really control birth, but you can prepare for birth. And then ultimately you need to surrender to whatever your baby is deciding to do on the day and what positions they're getting in and how your body's responding and all of that. Yeah, I love hearing that. I think that's really interesting to hear your own journey intertwined with the podcasting journey and hearing about all these hundreds of women's journeys and how that intersects with your personal life. I always think that's really fascinating. Now, you have obviously gone and written an entire book about preparing for labor and birth. So I think it's really important that we talk about this because, as you've already acknowledged in the last episode, is that so many women who described having a traumatic or negative birth experience boiled down to a lot of the time not having adequate preparation or adequate education or information. And I'm not sure about you, Soph, when you started birth classes and things like that, but I know my experience of what was offered as a hospital birth class doesn't even come close to touching what I think should be in a hospital birth class. But I want to ask you first, of all the women that you've interviewed, there's obviously going to be some strong themes coming through here. What's the general theme of what women wish they had known beforehand?
All the smaller things, I think, and all the options. I feel like people often say, I didn't know I could ask for that, or I didn't know I could say no to that. And just with basic things like tests and things, and you can always say yes or no to anything that's happening to you and your body, obviously, but I think people forget that in that kind of power dynamic between a care provider and you as a patient. I think patient in inverted commas there. I think people are just like, we start the book with, I wish I had a known. And I feel like people are like, I wish I had a known even basic things that I could have gone and had a private midwife, or I could have gone publicly and had a private obstetrician, or just knowing the very basic options of what's out there rather than going with the first thing the GP that you saw recommends or the obstetrician your friend said was great. Knowing just even your birthing options and your care provider options is where the book kind of starts. And I think it's easy when you're in this space all the time and other people like yourself that are working in the space, we go into this kind of birth bubble. And I think Jodi and I, when we wrote the book, had to keep stepping back and going, we have to assume that some of these readers have just literally only just discovered when they ovulate right back to the beginning. They've got no understanding of what even a doula is, perhaps, or who a student midwife is and how you might get them to support you. So we really kept trying to step back and think of ourselves in our first pregnancies as well. And I didn't know if I should share this, but we did jokingly say we have to think of the birth dodos that know nothing and just don't assume anything. And I think I'm reminded of that really regularly. And I think Jodi was reminded of it recently. A woman came into the shop where she works and she didn't know about skin to skin. She was having trouble with breastfeeding. And I think maybe she'd had staff that were really under pressure, or perhaps she hadn't taken it in because she was stressed. But Jodi said, oh, just get your shirt off, just get lots of skin to really try and encourage breastfeeding. And we're like, wow, she hadn't even picked that up through the course of pregnancy or breastfeeding assistance and stuff. So we really wanted to make sure that the book was really easy to read, but really just had every little thing that you needed to consider. And I think that's why it took us so long to write and why it's so thick. But there's so much to cover, and we wanted to just do it in a really gentle and easy to pick up and read way, because you're exhausted in those first months. So we wanted to chunk it so you could just pick up bits that felt relevant at the time and come back to other bits later.
It's so interesting because you bang on with the basic information. That's not actually what I was expecting you to say with what women wish they'd known. But whenever I talk about the pelvic floor, for example, I think that, oh God, people are bored of this message. The pelvic floor, I talk about it all the time. And women are always like, oh my God, I didn't know this. I didn't know that's where my pelvic floor was. Like, I didn't know that's how you turn it on. I didn't even know it could control urination and going to the toilet. And I'm always like reminded when I have those conversations that, oh yeah, Laura, like you're so thick in this bubble of what you know, but so many women still don't know this basic education. And I guess our society is so far removed from pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. It's all very much behind doors. We don't see it out in public. Women are covering themselves up and birth is behind closed doors. We don't visualize that. We don't get to see that. We can't assume that women know this. So I hear you when you say that. You've really got to be able to zoom out. And I imagine that would have been really hard to write, because you're like, oh yeah, skin to skin. Everyone knows that, don't they? But you really have to be able to tailor it to the person that's, maybe they didn't even know about ovulation. They just fell pregnant. And now they're like, whoa, what to do now? And really interesting what you said about the systems and like the different options that you have for your care. I myself, who would call myself very well educated in the pregnancy and birth space, had no idea about all the different care options when I was coming into my third birth, because I'd only ever picked the same path the first two times. I went private OB and I had never explored other options. So when it came to the third option, I remember somebody sat me down and said, okay, these are your five options of care. And I was like, what? Really? No, there was that many options where I live and things around me. And I just remember thinking, wow, like I work in this space. I've already had two babies and I still am so unaware about my choices and my options. What's somebody who's never even thought about pregnancy or birth going to, how are they going to know which option of care to go? And the scary thing is that so many of those really great options like midwifery care and all of that get booked out really early, right? If it takes you a while to find your feed and work out what you want, unfortunately, a lot of the time you miss out on that. So I guess there's so much value in doing the education and the work before you even fall pregnant, if you have the opportunity to do. And just going back finally to that first point you made about women just saying no to something, like knowing that they have an option in all the things are presented to them. Again, with my third pregnancy, it took me this long to really have things click into place. I remember a midwife friend of mine saying that she was talking to a client and whatnot, and she said to the client, like, you don't have to have the diabetes test. It's just an option for you. And I turned to her and I was like, can you say that? Is it really? And she was like, yeah, Laura, of course. Like, it's just an option. And it was mind-blowing to me, because I was like, I didn't realize I could say no. I kind of just thought that it was like, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. I guess maybe that's my personality in my first two. But I wish someone had said that to me. Like, I wish someone had gone, oh yeah, everything is an option, a choice for you to either say yes or no to. You're in control. You're in charge. So I just wanted to share that in case someone is listening and going, yeah, I feel like a total newbie. I was there. I'm sure Sophie was there.
It's overwhelming. Well. Yeah. You're not expected to know until you're in this space. You probably have never heard of, maybe you've never heard of an epidural or episiotomy or, yeah, the grippy strep test. But, and I feel like you touched on earlier about how the podcast is impartial. We really wanted to make sure the book was as best. We've really tried very hard to not steer anyone one way or another. So it's a book that someone who's planning a home birth could read. It's also a book that someone who knows they need to have a cesarean or they choose to have a cesarean, that they can still pick up this book and not feel like, oh, it's putting down my choice for whatever reason. So I think we don't say, oh, you should never do this test or think twice before you do this. We just say, here's this test. This is what it involves. Here's the reasons why you might want to do it. Here's the reasons why some people have chosen not to. Up to you what you decide. And I think that's the crux of kind of consenting to these different things. It's informed consent. If you're just saying yes because you don't know what it even is, then that's not informed consent. So knowing what it is and deciding what's right for you and really weighing that up is so important.
100%. That's true informed consent. Like what you're laying out there, like this is what it's for. Yeah, this is the pros and the cons and it's up to you what you that's true informed consent. So I think that's really beautiful that you added that. I think that's going to be such a powerful thing for women just to sit back and consider. And it might be a yes for everything, but at least you're saying yes from a truly informed place. I think that's the main thing. Now, I imagine you're inundated with messages all the time, and I know you have a lot of resources on preparation. Like I've contributed to your birth class series, and that is such a popular one for women to prepare. You've obviously got the book now. What do you see women are seeking when it comes to information in the lead up to birth? So, What are they coming to you saying, hey, I really want to learn about this, or I really want to know about this? What seems to be the theme of what women are seeking when it comes to birth preparation?
I think they just want to know, yeah, as many well-rounded options so that they can pull on a tool that suits them. Because I think there's terms like, there's kind of models of birthing, like hypnobirthing, that I feel like people have a general understanding, but they want to know, is that going to be a good fit for them and what's involved? And we don't unpack all the different types of birthing styles in the book, but I feel like the podcast faces a lot of people doing different approaches and that's how it worked for them. And then it's up to you to then decipher. And throughout the book, we've also got birth stories and you think, okay, so she chose this and this is what happened and her motivations for choosing that were similar to what mine are. So maybe it's a good fit for me. So then they can go away and make that kind of decision. But I think people, it's like refreshing to see that people want to take more control of their birth. And I think that has ended perhaps with COVID, with restrictions on hospitals, and rightly we've had to make certain adjustments for COVID. But people are thinking, oh, I'm losing my power a bit in this. And it's a huge physical experience for both you and the baby, and it's a life-altering moment and you want it to go as well as possible and you really want to enjoy that experience. And I feel like women are now seeing that in order to achieve what they want, they're really going to have to do the work and educate themselves. And it feels like the beginning of motherhood, like it catches you off guard initially, but you're like, all right, the onus is on me now to step up and make some decisions. And doing that early in pregnancy, I think, just really starts you building your kind of that muscle of trusting your gut and going with what's right for you and not necessarily what everybody else is doing, but what's right for you and your family and your vision. Yeah, I think perhaps it's designed that way to start building your confidence, because it's pretty hard at the other side as well. And I think there's a lot of people that are dismissive. Oh, it's one day. And there are perhaps a lot of people that have go with the flow. Like, it's one day, it'll be terrible, the pain's terrible. And then you get on with the hard stuff. And there's a grain of truth to that. It doesn't go on for months and months. It is usually no longer than perhaps 4 or 5 days, but maybe 1 hour. You're on the other end of the scale there. But I think it's dismissive to say that it's not important. And as you say, like, you remember the details, you remember what time it was and what the nurse was wearing and all sorts of things like that. So women don't forget that experience. And if it's traumatic, it can have long-term repercussions for forever. And physical, you obviously deal with a lot of the physical ramifications of a birth that hasn't perhaps gone. And I've got prolapse issues myself and things like that. So they're going to be a constant reminder. So I think it's yeah, it's inappropriate to just dismiss it as, oh, people are making a big fuss over it. And I think older generations are a bit like, oh, you're trying to be the obstetrician and the midwife, and you're not. You're just trying to take control of your own experience. And yeah, and I think it's what you have to do in this day and age, particularly with kind of shortages of staff and limited options and hospital closures and stuff. You've got to advocate for yourself and you've got to educate yourself.
100%. Yeah, I resonate with all those messages, Sophie, like the ownership of your birth and listening to your intuition and strengthening that in pregnancy, because boy, oh boy, you're going to need that when you become a mother. You're going to need to lean on that intuition so strongly. And that notion as well of, I say this to so many women all the time, but birth can mean so much more to you if you want it to, because I think there is a lot of that. I remember someone saying to me when I was trying to explain why I wanted to be back, they were like, I don't get it though. It's just like a little bit of pain and then you push a baby out. And I was like, yeah, but it means so much more to me than that. And that's okay. Like for anyone out there who has maybe heard that before, like it's okay to want more from birth, like to see it as this big rite of passage and for it to mean more to you than just one day and then it's over and done with. It can really affect how your life goes afterwards in both a positive and a negative way. But yeah, I think it's really important to reclaim how powerful birth is for so many women. And it may not be for others, and that's fine too. But yeah, I really resonate with all those messages. I think that's, yeah, really beautiful for women to be hearing. Now, when it comes to birth education, what do you think personally, what do you think is missing in birth education, I guess, in Australia as like a mainstream option right now?
I've done the hospital birth classes, like you said, that are very limited, and they're perhaps like we pass around the ventus and had a look at that and a few things. And they said, look, if you're having a cesarean, suddenly there'll be 8 people in the room. Let's all get 8 people to stand up and lie down in the middle and see what that's like. And they're well-meaning, lovely midwives at my hospital, but they're just limited with resources and time. And I just think 4 hours or 2 4-hour sessions in a hospital with a bunch of people you've never met is not an ideal way to educate yourself about birth. And I still encourage everyone to do their hospital classes, because every hospital is so different and their policies are different. It's a good opportunity to ask about certain things. If my waters go, what's your policy? Will I be induced after 24 hours, or will I get antibiotics and go home, or what? Those sorts of things. And also so important to explore the space, know where the operating theatre is and that sort of stuff. But I think you need to go into those classes having done your own homework. And I think I've had so much kind of love and support from midwives and obstetricians, because they want to have more time with people and they want to be able to impart this. And that's why they've gone into this calling and this work life. But they're just so limited with the amount of time they've got for people. And so I've had a lot of feedback of people saying, oh, we're so relieved to be able to say, now go and listen to the podcast for more firsthand accounts, or get this book. And then it prompts people to come in with questions. So when you've got your 10 or 15 minute slot, which is what I had with my midwife, you go, oh, now I just want to ask you about this test, or I've just remembered that the baby doesn't move a lot at this stage of the day and blah, blah, blah. But I think if you go in and you forget and you're pregnant, so you're preoccupied and your blood flows in different areas and all sorts of things going on. So I think going in and arming yourself with all of that helps support the system, and then you can get the best out of your care provider as well. And it's like a synergy. We need all of the moving parts, but I think just hospitals and staff are really under such constraints that they can't give the care that they'd like to. And that's where we hope to be bridging that gap a little bit with some of our resources.
Yeah, 100%. That's where collaboration is key, because like you said, it's impossible for a doctor or a midwife to be able to impart all of the knowledge that you would learn in a birth class and your hypnobirthing or whatever avenue you decide to go down. And also they're assuming that you want to know that knowledge. So it's much better for women to be able to seek this information and these resources easily. And then, like you said, present the questions to their care provider. That's going to make their life much easier, because they can just reflect back. They know all the answers, but it's impossible for them to be imparting all that wisdom to each individual person that comes into their room in a 10-minute slot, like you said. Like, that's where I think it's so important to zoom out and see the system for what it is and its limitations, and then take that ownership yourself and go, okay, sweet. Hospital birth class, very important for all of those reasons you just listed, but I'm going to need to do some supplemental, you know, education, because that's not going to cover all the bases for me. And I think that's really powerful. Like, and that's why OBs obviously love you and midwives, because it's that collaboration piece. It helps them, it helps you, and ultimately it helps the birthing woman. And I think that's, yeah, really important. Now, you mentioned some questions already that women should be thinking about. when it comes to their environment and what are your policies on this. But off the top of your head, can you think of some really key questions that women should be thinking about in the lead up to birth? Questions to be asking themselves, their partners, their care team. What are some really important things that you think women should be asking?
I think the important questions to ask when you're choosing your care provider is just knowing that you can ask for things like stats of what's your intervention rate, what's your cesarean rate, what's your policy around inducing? Do you induce after 40 plus 1 days, or would you be comfortable with going to 40 plus 10, or those sorts of questions, which again, you have to know to ask them. So I feel like a lot of kind of second time mums and third time mums would be asking that sort of stuff. But I think in the lead up to the birth, I think notoriously people are like, my obstetrician or my midwife was really chilled about me going post over my estimated due date. And then suddenly when I got to 39 plus six, they said, well, book an induction in. And I think you need to have worked out your approach of what you want ahead of that time, because then you're emotional and on the spot. But if you think, no, we've talked about this and I've decided based on the research that I've done that I am comfortable provided the ultrasound's well and there's enough fluid and the baby's happy, my stance on this is I would like to go with daily monitoring over each day or just have a plan. But if you leave it till the last stage, when I feel like in each of my pregnancies, I got to a stage where you think, just get it out. I don't even care how it comes. So I think you need to do those when you're feeling like fresh and perhaps in the middle of the pregnancy. I think there's no start planning at 37 weeks, or there's no like time to when you should educate yourself. It should be like pre-baby, ideally, as early as possible. So you got plenty of time to have those chats and have that chat with your partner so they know, oh yeah, I understand that. And your reasons for that are because of you want these three things to happen. Similarly with like skin to skin. So if you say to your partner, look, I really want to make sure if we do need an emergency cesarean that, and if for some reason the baby and I have to be separated, I really want you to do skin to skin. And here's why I want you to do that, and then be on the same page. But if you're not having those discussions, then it's easy to miss those opportunities. And it is hustle and bustle and there's lots going on. So if you're not saying, I really want to do, perhaps delayed cord clamping is not a great example because most people just do that as part of their policy now. But things like that to advocate for yourself and have in your birth plan is really important.
I love all of that. I agree with you in that. So good to do that beforehand when you're in that really steady state of mind and you can have a really healthy communication with you and your partner and your birth team without it being like the rush of hormones and the hustle bustle, and that can make it really tricky. So going back to Sophie pre-first birth, what do you wish that you had known prior to your first birth? What questions do you wish that you had asked?
I don't think I had a solid understanding of kind of that, perhaps now with the knowledge I have, I think I couldn't get past 5 centimeters because the baby wasn't in a good position. And I just thought, my body's not doing birth well. Maybe I just don't dilate. I didn't think, perhaps I could do different physical techniques or try more hip opening things or start lunging and things. Like, I would have approached that differently with the knowledge I have now. Mm-hmm. So I think I wish that I'd perhaps read more widely and focused perhaps more on mindset shifts, because I was pretty quick. I was tired. I shouldn't be mean to my former self, but I was just like, I'll bugger it. And yeah. Then we weren't married at the time, but Jonathan got in my face and said, remember how you said you don't want an epidural? I was like, I'm done with you. Get mum in here. So I'd worded him up enough to know that he was meant to discourage kind of interventions if possible. But I was just a hard and fast, all the drugs now, please. Mm. So I didn't prepare in that sense. And I think the benefits of what I knew with the second was understanding the physiology. And I could have worked perhaps more with that. I probably did more Pilates in recovering my pelvic floor from my first birth and had a better understanding and awareness of how the body kind of moves in birth and what the baby does and what the journey is that they have to undertake, and tried to work together rather than thinking, I've failed. What does he need? I didn't know it was a boy, but what does he need from me to help with this process?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you were able to take those things and use them as fuel for changing something in your second and your third births as well. And like you said, self-compassion, like you did the best with the information that you had at the time. Like, it's very easy to know what you know now and to look back and go, like, I just wish that I could have done X, Y, and Z and it would have maybe turned out differently. But, you know, that you did the best that you knew how at the time. And then you changed because you knew you needed to. And yeah, I think there's a lot of women out there probably doing a similar thing where maybe they're blaming themselves or making it mean something about them. But I think compassion is definitely the first step on making sure that you're kind to yourself. So if we've talked a lot about the system and the maternity system in Australia is specifically what we're talking about, because that's the women that you're working with and that's the women that you're interviewing, what do you see as the main issues with the maternity system in Australia at the moment? And I'd love to know what you think is like the way forward. We know that birth trauma is through the roof at the moment. We know that there's obviously something that's not working right now when one in three, I believe, women are reporting birth trauma. So what do you see as the main systemic problems? And I'd love to know what you're doing to, I know you're big into advocacy at the moment. I'd love to know what you're doing to move towards a better option or better stats for the Australian maternity system.
Yeah, it's so hard. I feel like we know that the best outcome for mother and baby is to have a known care provider through pregnancy, birth and postpartum. Like we've known that for years and there's really strong studies on it. It's all out there and yet no one seems to, and no one except kind of the midwives that are banging that drum, kind of there's been no policy or funding or structural change for as long as I can see to try and reduce those numbers and get greater access when we know that it's the best. So that's not to discredit kind of care with an obstetrician, because that is also falls under that continuity of care, but the actual kind of the studies support midwifery care for that. And I think those numbers, like it's 8%, but it's probably less at the moment. I know like down where you are, they've just closed the private hospital in Geelong, which just means that all those women that were birthing there and now referred over onto the other hospitals and just puts more pressure and demand. And particularly like in Victoria and down in Geelong, that's the fastest growing area for young families. So we know that there's going to be more demand on those services and yet they're closing down and it doesn't look like the government's doing anything to catch that. We need more hospitals and more staffing and more options and yet we're losing them. And there doesn't seem to be enough alarm in enough areas. I feel like in Gladstone, that's probably had more media coverage. In Queensland, that's a town of 60,000 plus people. They have between 300 and 400 births a year. And they don't have a maternity system at the moment with an obstetrician on. So if you go into labor in Gladstone, you have to drive an hour and a half to the nearest hospital in Rockhampton. And then Rockhampton has then had to absorb all these births. So not only is it incredibly stressful for the families who, if, for example, you've got gestational diabetes, you need to stay out of pocket in a hotel near Rockhampton so that you can be close to the hospital. There's small things that have changed. They've said, we will take low-risk births. We won't take low-risk births. You can have an obstetrician on Wednesday, Thursday. Like it's really been, but it's been 280 odd days. So nearly a year of all these women and their families not knowing where they're birthing. And we know that a really important component of reporting having a good birth experience is to know where you're birthing and know who you're birthing with. And none of these women know that. And it depends who's in charge on the day, more or less. Mm-hmm. And I've interviewed a woman who was able to birth at Gladstone because she presented and they said, you're actually too far along to make the journey down the highway. So she birthed there, but then she had a hemorrhage and then had to transfer via ambulance and then was away from her toddler. Not only without looking at those kind of dire situations, we already didn't have enough access and we don't have enough options. And we're in a first world country with Medicare and it just feels like it's just not good enough. You shouldn't have to travel an hour and a half away and just have whoever's on the day birth or assist you with your birth. And that Rockhampton hospitals had a whole lot of obstetricians and midwives strike last year. So it feels like it's not long until they collapse. They're also taking another neighboring hospital's births. And it just feels like I feel like I've got a position and I've got an opportunity to give voice to these things. But I'm also very aware that I'm not on the ground and I'm not a midwife and I'm not seeing these people individually. So I feel a sense of, oh, I'm speaking on behalf of other people. But anecdotally from the people I have spoken to, one midwife said it takes 6 months for a midwife to become an endorsed midwife. So to have a higher level of skills and be able to do a certain level of extra care, they can administer different drugs, they can prescribe different drugs, they can do perhaps like a third degree suture. And then refer somebody on, but they could triage and give more care to a lot of the women, say, for example, in Gladstone, and it would take 6 months for those midwives to be trained up. And yet for the last year, nothing's happened. They're just like, oh, we've got job ads up looking for doctors. And so it's Yeah, I don't know. I feel like so lucky to have had the experience I have had in continuity of care with a midwife. And I know firsthand how effective that was. And yet the government's not doing anything. It feels like everyone's tearing their hair out with the government in Queensland. People are tearing their hair out with the government in Victoria. And then, oh, there's one in Tasmania that's just shut down. It feels like it's now time for the federal government to come in and really improve outcomes for Australian women, because just from a public health perspective, it's so short-sighted to let all of these things unfold. And then you're going to have long-term implications for the baby, who's perhaps then had a traumatized mother caring for them, who's had trouble with breastfeeding, who's then the knock-on effect is so great. And it just seems, from a budgeting perspective, a cheap alternative to just not only a moral kind of just like supporting the community and supporting women and their families and really valuing and appreciating the importance of birth, but from if they're just looking at it as a financial situation, it just is more cost effective. And it's just incredibly disappointing. And yeah, as I say, I'm not on the ground, so I can't really speak on behalf of people, but from what people are reporting back to me and these devastated women who don't know where they're birthing, it's just heartbreaking.
I know you feel like you're maybe not the person because you're not on the ground. I actually think you're like expertly placed to be this advocate, because you're hearing from the people on the ground. You're hearing from the women on the ground giving birth. You're hearing, I'm sure, from the midwives and the doctors. And I'm sure you're hearing from loads of health professionals about the squeeze that they're feeling at the moment. Plus, you have the platform to be able to reach and share a message loud and wide, to be able to talk to media and get this message out there, and to be that conduit between the people on the ground who are probably too overwhelmed to even get to the advocacy piece. They're just on the ground doing their amazing work. So I actually think you're really well placed. Plus, you add in your public health background. Yeah, I think give more credit to yourself, because I actually think you're in a really, yeah, important position to be able to do that. And I see you pop up on the news and I see your name in articles. And I just think it's really wonderful that you're getting the message out there that change needs to happen, because what you're telling me, I wasn't unaware of. And it's alarming. These women must be so anxious not knowing where they're giving birth or who's going to be able to provide care for them. And are they going to be 2 hours away from their families, or are they going to be able to be close to home? And that's just one example, like you're saying. And I know there was a big push, yeah, down my way to stop the closure of a big private hospital, because women need this service. But unfortunately, so much of it feels out of our control. And no matter how hard you petition, it just seems to be like just not quite enough. I don't know what the answer is, really, yeah, apart from pushing this. I think it's not as simple as if we just do X, then this will happen. But I do wonder where the tipping point is, where it receives the attention it needs, when you know that the stats are 1 in 3 women reporting birth trauma, intervention rates at an all-time high. And like you said, from a public health point of view, let alone from an individual woman feeling traumatized and that affecting her life, but from a public health point of view, it is so much more expensive for women to not be having great birth experiences. Like you said, for the baby, for the mother, that becomes really taxing and costly down the track. So, and I'm sure you can speak to that much better than myself. I've not studied public health, but I understand it enough to know that when you're looking at dollar signs.
It makes sense. Yeah. And I guess we focused on birth, but there's a lot of other implications with having those services, and particularly in Geelong down your way. It's if women are wanting to have terminations or a termination for medical reasons or those sorts of procedures, they've got lack of options as well. And one of the other leading hospitals in Victoria down that are picking up that kind of pool of women that have been dropped by the system and then have got an option of going to St. John of God, who for religious reasons don't do a number of those procedures. So there's so many different layers to it. And it's just a basic human right that in a country such as Australia, and any country ideally, but you have access to this level of care. And it's just setting you off on a back foot as a mother, just being disrespected, really. And it's a feminist issue. So there's so many layers to it.
It's complex. And just to confirm, were you saying that only 8% of the population has access to continuity of care?
Through a public model, yeah.
Yes, okay. So the evidence is showing that continuity of care is the best outcome for mother and baby, correct?
Yeah.
Only 8% have access. That's alarming, isn't it? If we have evidence to say that this is numero uno approach, yet only
8%. And I feel like probably with who you liaise with as well, I feel like the majority of midwives that I speak to love that model of care, because they do get to know the family and support them through. So Yeah, it's so challenging. And I think if it was a simple answer of a sum of money or a certain number of midwives need to be trained, then that would be more achievable. But it really is multi-layered and needs a multifaceted approach that I think needs to come from a federal perspective now.
When you were talking earlier about midwives upskilling to become endorsed midwives so that they can take more of a lead role in someone's birth as opposed to needing to rely on doctors, what was the barrier they were coming up against there? What was stopping them from being able to upskill? Was that a funding issue as well?
I'm not actually sure. I mean, before I went on the news recently to discuss it, I reached out to a leading midwife who works in Queensland, and she was seeing that as one kind of interim support that would really triage a lot of those patients and take the pressure off Rockhampton and allow women to birth where they're wanting to birth, close to home. And that would be one avenue to take in, perhaps medium risk, if you want to categorize it in that way. Because at the moment they're saying low risk, and it's easy to run the maths on a low risk pregnancy. Like that woman that I had on, she had a postpartum hemorrhage. She was low risk. The birth went well, but then she hemorrhaged. You need to have different things in place. And ideally you do want a fully staffed obstetric team in those hospitals. But it's unusual that, I'm not sure why they haven't tried some interim things. I feel like it sounds like they've just put seek ads up looking for doctors and going, oh, no one wants to move to Gladstone to do it. It's hard to get a team of people to come in. This hospital struggled for 280 days. I don't know if looking at an ad and knowing what you know of that area, it's not enticing. So no, it's really hard.
Yeah, it's very tricky. And I imagine you'd be talking to a lot of health professionals with the work that you do. I imagine a lot of them are quite frustrated at the situation they're in, where they maybe don't feel like they can provide the care they need because they are understaffed and overworked. And do you get that feedback as well from health professionals that they're in this bind where they can't really provide the care they need because they need the levels up to be able to provide more support?
Yeah, and all walks of different kind of healthcare professionals that have touch points with people. I think a lot of physios and Pilates instructors and stuff can see the value in doing care throughout pregnancy, and then perhaps it's not suggested. And then it's very, with the financial challenges, it's really hard for people. And so I think it doesn't become a number one priority for people, and then perhaps they regret it postnatally. Mm. But the system doesn't support kind of recovery and nurturing yourself. And it's just frustrating when we know that basic care and then simple kind of exercises and things like which you obviously share in your membership, but a lot of people aren't getting access to that. And I had one lady come and get really angry with me because she's now got a prolapse, and she said, "And I feel like I've heard you've got a prolapse, and why didn't you tell me?" And I was like, "Oh, I can't solve every problem." And but we're all I don't know, but I think there's people have an unusual kind of bond with me because they listen to me throughout the pregnancy. And so it's a unique position. But I feel like, every area of healthcare is under pressure, and its access in rural areas is challenging, and funding. And there's a lot that needs to be done. And you can see it being done well in other countries. So it's disappointing. But
I was just about to say, I remember someone telling me that the French have like free pelvic health physio appointments at the
city. They come to your home as well.
And I remember as a physio being like, yes, please. Like, it would save so many women so much pain postnatally if they had that access. But I guess my ethos on this, and I'm sure yours is quite similar, it's so hard to generate systemic change because it takes a long time, and it takes, like you said, there's so many layers. It's not as easy as if we just did this, it would change everything for everyone. Mm. So I guess I always go back to, regardless of the system, we can still empower the individual, and we can still, regardless of whether that mother has to transfer an hour and a half, or we can still give her all the tools and all the knowledge and all the resources to be able to have a wonderful birth. And assuming you have a similar ethos, I imagine that's why you wrote the book. That's your version of advocacy, is to be like,
what I can help.
Yeah, exactly. I can inform these women of all of the choices and all of the ways that you can help manage labor and all of the options to you, so that regardless of what system you end up and how that system is working at the time, that you yourself are really empowered and informed. So I imagine that's why you brought out the book, like you said, because that's your version of being able to help. Is there anything else you're doing? I'm just curious to know, to really try and action change in the maternity system at the moment.
It's hard. I had some grand plans for this year, and then I think I just have to remind myself after launching the book, and now we've just signed a second book deal, so another book coming. And I think I feel like I also need to, I'm so passionate, and I've obviously got a platform and I want to utilize that, but I also I'm promoting leaning in and self-care and being child-focused. And I feel like my youngest is 4, so he still needs a lot of attention. They always will. But I think I am pausing some of my grand plans. I went through a phase of thinking maybe I should do a PhD. They got a lot of ideas, but I'm trying to then balance that with 3 small kids. Yeah, the next big thing on the agenda is going to be our second book, which is going to be very much postpartum focused.
Yes, and, so exciting.
Yeah, and some more courses and things coming. But yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and I'll continue to try and give a voice to these issues as best I can and use my communities. Have entrusted me with all of this, yeah, beautiful, rich data. So if the more I can share it and use it to advocate for change, I will.
Yeah, I love that. My next question to wrap up this interview, you've already answered, but I'm going to ask you anyway. But personally and professionally, I'd just really love to know what's driving you right now, what's motivating you right now, and yeah, what's next for you? So you've already answered a little bit professionally, but personally as well, I'd love to know where you're at.
Yeah, I'm really trying to, I was going to say find the balance. There is no balance, but I'm trying to just be, I listen to your podcast and some of the incredible people you interview on like resilience and being present. And so I'm trying to be a gold standard mother as well as advocate for change. And I love doing the podcast, so I'm never going to stop doing that. And I find it logistically, like I'm sure you will, hard to find the time. Making appointments for podcasts, but then when you sit down and do them, I just think, oh, I love doing this. And I feel so fortunate to be able to have a flexible job that I can work around the children that kind of pays the bills. So I'm very grateful for that. Yeah, I don't know. I'm also trying to find like hobbies and times. I'm not going to take up surfing. I find it very impressive that you're doing
Come
that.
Come on.
I'll leave that to my kids. But yeah, I think
Jono would love it if you surf, surely.
Oh yeah. I don't think I could lift up my body weight, but we'll see. You might see me on a wave down there. But I feel like I need to incorporate a bit more just time for myself as well. So how I pull that off, I'm not quite sure. But we're going on an exciting family holiday to Japan. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And like you said, it's this elusive balance that is really hard. You're trying to dominate the world. You're trying to create governmental change. You're trying to educate women. You're trying to raise 3 boys. You're trying to a successful marriage and a home. And there's so many balls in the air. And I think it's just acknowledging that you can not necessarily do it all at one time. Something has to give. And maybe these big grand career plans have to be shelved for a few years while your kids are young. And I feel that push and pull so strongly. And I feel like anyone that works, does paid work while also mothering, definitely resonates with that message. And I think women would really appreciate hearing your version of how you do it all, because I'm sure you get that question all the time. Sophie, you run this podcast, you have these books, you're an author, you're writing a second book. How do you do it all? You're so real and honest, and you're just, like you said to me before, you're just going one day at a time. Lucky if it's 1 week at a time. It's normally one day at a time. So yeah, that's really refreshing to hear, I feel. And I'm so grateful that you joined us on this podcast. I think I've got a really like interesting insight into you that even I wasn't aware of. So I think it's really cool to be able to bump brains with someone who's had so much experience in this space, listening to women. Like I said, I think you're in this unique position where you're hearing from so many different women and so many different healthcare professionals. And you've got this platform, which is amazing. So kudos to you for building that and doing such an amazing job. Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't covered or any final words that you want to share with the women listening?
No, I think we've covered it all.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining me, Sophie. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Hey, mamas, I really hope that you loved that episode with Sophie. It was a nice, long, full-form interview, which I'm not used to doing on the podcast, but I think it gives you a really good summary of everything we speak about all at once. Take it home and I digest it. And like I said in the intro, I think Sophie has a really unique perspective on birth at the moment, and I really wanted to get her view on what she thinks is working and not working. And I think there's so much we can take from this interview. So I really hope you loved it. If you haven't already, go to Australian Birth Stories podcast and check out all of her amazing stories. If you scroll right back, you'll see my 2 C-section stories on there from way back in the day. I'd be shocked to probably listen to them now. I'm a very different woman to who I was back then, but nonetheless, it would be very interesting to listen to. And you can find her on Instagram or social media at Australian Birth Stories. If you love this episode, if you have any feedback on it, I'd love to hear from you over at Physio Laura. Please come and let me know. I am excited to be back podcasting again and getting these interviews out to you that I recorded before we left for this caravan trip. There's an epic one coming out next week, which is for all the pregnant mamas, anyone preparing to birth. It's going to be amazing. So please make sure you subscribe to the Pregnancy with Physio Laura podcast so that you don't miss out. And otherwise, come and connect with me at Physio Laura. I'd so love to hear from you. I'd love to know what you've been up to in this hiatus that we've had on the podcast. But yeah, it's good to be back. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you next week.